Okay, you're on air.
Good evening and welcome to Senator Jim Risch's live telephone town hall. My name is Marty and I will be your host for tonight's town hall meeting. Thank you for joining us. We hope you will find this call informative and useful. In a moment, Senator Risch will join us with some opening remarks. Following these remarks, Senator Risch will begin taking your questions. Please press zero at any time during tonight's event to submit your question. After you dial zero, you will speak to a staff member who will assist you by taking your question. This is a live question and answer session with Senator Risch. Remember, if you would like to ask a question, please press zero on your telephone keypad. You will then be transferred to a staff member who will take your name and question. You can also press zero if you would like to simply leave a comment or if you have an issue that you need assistance with. Also, if you wish to receive future e-newsletters and other information from Senator Risch, please press zero to speak with a staff member who will take down your address and other information. Additionally, you can follow Senator Risch on Twitter at the handle @SenatorRisch. We'd like to get through as many of your questions as possible. To help us accomplish this goal, we must limit all callers to only one question. If your question is chosen, I will say your name and ask you to repeat your question for Senator Risch. Once again, to submit a question, please press zero at any time during the call. You will be transferred to a member of staff who will take your name and your question. You can also press zero at any time if you would like to take a question. I will now go through this all one more time as we still have callers that are joining. Just as a refresher, my name is Marty and I will be your host for tonight's town hall meeting. Thank you for joining us. We hope that you will find this call informative and useful. In a moment, Senator Risch will join us with some opening remarks. Following these remarks, Senator Risch will begin taking your questions. Please press zero at any time during tonight's event to submit your question. After you dial zero, you will speak with a staff member who will assist you by taking your question. This is a live question and answer session with Senator Risch. Remember, if you would like to ask a question, please press zero on your telephone keypad. You will then be transferred to a staff member who will take your name and question. You can also press zero if you would like to simply leave a comment or if you have an issue that you need assistance with. Also, if you wish to receive future e-newsletters and other information from Senator Risch, please press zero to speak with a staff member who will take down your address and other information. Additionally, you can follow Senator Risch on Twitter at the handle @SenatorRisch. We'd like to get through as many of your questions as possible. To help us accomplish this goal, we must limit all callers to only one question. If your question is chosen, I will say your name and ask you to repeat your question for Senator Risch. Once again, to submit a question, please press zero at any time during the call. You will be transferred to a member of staff who will take your name and your question. You can also press zero at any time if you would like to leave a comment or if you have an issue you need assistance with. We look like we are still having people joining the call. I'm going to go through this one more time. I do apologize for repeating myself. Good evening and welcome to Senator Jim Risch's live telephone town hall. My name is Marty and I will be your host for tonight's town hall meeting. Thank you for joining us and we hope you will find this call informative and useful. In a moment, Senator Risch will join us with some opening remarks. Following these remarks, Senator Risch will begin taking your questions. Please press zero at any time during tonight's event to submit your question. After you dial zero, you will speak with a staff member who will assist you by taking your question. This is a live question and answer session with Senator Risch. Remember, if you would like to ask a question, please press 0 on your telephone keypad. You will then be transferred to a staff member who will take your name and question. If you also, you can also press 0 if you would like to simply leave a comment or if you have an issue that you also need assistance with. If you wish to receive future e-newsletters and other information from Senator Risch, please press 0 to speak with the staff member who will take down your address and other information. Additionally, you can follow Senator Risch on Twitter at the handle @SenatorRisch. We'd like to get through as many of your questions as possible. To help us accomplish this goal, we must limit all callers to only one question. If your question is chosen, I will say your name and ask you to repeat your question for Senator Risch. Once again, to submit a question, please press 0 at any time during the call. You will be transferred to a member of staff who will take your name and your question. You can also press 0 at any time if you would like to simply leave a comment or if you have an issue you need assistance with. I will now have Senator Risch join us with some opening remarks. Following his remarks, we will begin taking your question. Senator Risch, the floor is yours.
Well, Marty, thank you very much. And most of all, thank you to all of you who are joining us and participating in this town hall meeting. Tonight's event gives us the opportunity to speak about what's happening in Washington, D.C., and answer questions or concerns you have for me. We won't be able to get to everyone's questions during the event, but once the event is over, you will have the ability to leave your question or comment with a member of my staff, and we will get a response to you as soon as possible. By way of introduction, I was first elected to the United States Senate in 2008. Since I came to work in Washington, the financial condition of the country has been the biggest priority that I have and is certainly the most urgent problem that America faces. It doesn't get talked about much, and that's been a big surprise to me. Money is spent here like water, and they just don't pay enough attention to it. On a really good day out of the 100 senators, there's only a handful of us that are really concerned about this. During the first 4 years I was here, the federal government spent about $3.8 trillion each year. That comes out to about $11 billion a day. To put that in perspective, when I was governor of the great state of Idaho, the annual budget for the state was $3.5 billion. So in a day, they spend more than three times the yearly budget of the state of Idaho every single day, and this boggles my mind, and it's really completely unacceptable. But worse than that, the federal government doesn't have that kind of money to spend. When I arrived here in Washington, the national debt was at about $10 trillion. Today it is nearly $23 trillion, and the government has spent more than $4.5 trillion this year alone. It's difficult really to comprehend that because our minds really cannot conceive those kinds of numbers. I really don't know what a trillion is, and I suspect most people can't come close to even understanding what that is. But when you put it into perspective that this year we've spent $12 billion every day, with much of that money going directly towards entitlements, you start to understand the gravity of the problem. As Americans, we've got to get this right. We have to continue to pressure the government to spend less money. For me, that means opposing reckless spending bills in the Senate. For you, it means urging your representatives in Congress to support fiscally responsible legislation. That's the only way we are going to get out of this. Things are tough, but the American people have been through tough times before, and I have every confidence that we will rise to the occasion and get through this. Certainly, everyone knows that we're in an unprecedented time, really, of prosperity in America. So even though we're racking up the debt, wages and salaries are higher, we have record low unemployment, and things just keep getting better financially. But from the government's perspective, the debt just keeps getting worse. One of my roles in representing Idaho is I serve as chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I'm one of only two senators who serve on both Foreign Relations Committee and the Intelligence Committees. These are busy assignments, but I've pursued these assignments because these issues are incredibly important to Idahoans. There are two other Idahoans who have chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Both lived in very different times than what we have today. One issue that is unique to my chairmanship, which the other two did not have, is it pertains to the Idaho renegotiation of the Columbia River Treaty. All treaties have to go through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and as chairman, only I control the agenda on it. So we are going to get a good treaty, or we're going to get no treaty at all. Since the 1960s, the United States and Canada have had an important relationship managing flood control and energy production governed through this treaty. The treaty has been beneficial to both our nations, but now the treaty must be modernized before portions of it expire in 2024. As both an Idahoan and the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the committee through which all international treaties must be approved, securing the central provisions of the treaty and strengthening our strategic relationship with Canada is of great importance, and as it relates to our water, it is of great significance to Idaho. Idahoans understand that water is our lifeblood, and we are going to do whatever it takes to guard that water, and that includes getting a Columbia River Treaty that treats Idaho very well. Many of you, particularly in eastern Idaho, have been following the news about two Idahoans who were recently detained in China on alleged international boundary trafficking charges. These Idahoans were running an English teaching program called China Horizons in Rexburg that predominantly hired undergraduate students from BYU Idaho to teach Chinese children. As chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the detainment of any American in a country that is openly hostile to the United States is of grave concern to me. As an Idahoan, this particular case leaves me deeply disturbed. My staff is working hard, along with myself, to coordinate with the families of the two detainees, and I'm continuing to press the U.S. State Department to deliver all possible information regarding the case and the conditions of their confinement. Their safety is of the utmost concern, and I will do everything in my power as Foreign Relations Chairman to bring these two Idahoans home. This Congress, I've also worked to bring a Women's Small Business Center back to Idaho. I made this a top priority because when women succeed in business, Idaho's labor force is made stronger and our communities are made healthier. To get this done, I met with community stakeholders and the Small Business Administration over the course of several years to tailor the Women's Business Center program to fit the needs of women entrepreneurs in Idaho. This past summer, I'm proud to say we succeeded in establishing an Idaho Women's Business Center with locations in the Treasure Valley and Magic Valley, as well as the University of Idaho campus. I've also been at work on issues pertaining to agriculture and energy in Idaho, including issues related to the Idaho National Lab. The Idaho National Lab has firmly established itself as our nation's flagship nuclear laboratory, a reputation that is recognized worldwide, and that history is still being written as the lab works to deploy the next generation of small modular, micro, and other advanced reactor designs. The research and development happening at the INL is truly groundbreaking, and in this Congress I've sponsored and co-sponsored bills to highlight and promote this great work and clear the way so that INL can continue to shape our energy, medical, manufacturing, and national security landscape. Speaking of national security in the Idaho National Laboratory, we have been the flagship laboratory for nuclear energy for many, many years. We are quickly becoming the flagship laboratory for cybersecurity. Myself and a number of other people up here are convinced that the next very significant in America will be a cybersecurity event. We are under attack every second on the internet, and all of us know how important that the computer and the internet is to running virtually all parts of our economy and much of our private lives. These are just a few of the things happening in Washington. I'm sure you'll have many more questions for me relating to everything from defense to trade to healthcare. I'm looking forward to your questions tonight and hope that you'll find this teletown hall useful and informative. So with that, I'll have Marty take the first question.
Thank you, Senator. For anyone who is just joining us to submit a question, please press 0. You will be transferred to a member of staff who will take your name and your question. If your question is chosen, I will say your name and ask you to repeat your question for Senator Risch. Senator, before we get started, I'd like to ask you about the impeachment proceedings happening in the House. Last week, the House approved a resolution formalizing the impeachment process along party lines. Your statement on these proceedings has been, "We are in a very partisan and volatile time in American politics, and the House's impeachment inquiry has clearly inflamed these ongoing tensions. It's unproductive to weigh in on each and every development. Rather than commenting on every new piece of information, I am monitoring these issues and will comment if and when impeachment proceedings move to the Senate, and I have cast my vote as a juror in those impeachment proceedings. In the meantime, as chairman, I will, of course, weigh in on the status of and path forward on foreign relations and other matters. And I would just like to know, does this formalized vote in the House change anything about this statement?
Well, this is a very political process. You know, the Founding Fathers took the removal of the chief executive, the President of the United States, very seriously. I do too, and my colleagues here in the Senate, I believe, whichever side of the aisle they sit on, also take this matter very seriously. The way this works is the House of Representatives, the 435 of them, can bring charges against the president, and they can then vote. And by a simple majority vote, they accuse the president of certain things, supposedly things that are impeachable offenses. And then the matter comes to the United States Senate for trial. And as such, all 100 of us sit as jurors on that trial. And at the end of it, the Senate will vote, and the question will be presented, shall the president be removed from office? And obviously, it'll be a yes or a no vote. If 67 of the 100 vote to remove him, that's two-thirds vote, then the president is removed. Now, in history, there's only been a few attempts at this. Two actually went through a trial in the Senate, but no president has ever been removed from office. Richard Nixon was accused, but resigned, and did not go through the process. So this is historical. It's important. We take it seriously, but the guidelines that were given by the Founding Fathers are pretty broad, high crimes and misdemeanors, and the political process really comes into play here. As was noted, the vote in the House to even proceed was strictly along party lines. So it is a political exercise, but nonetheless, it has to be taken seriously, and all of us do. The unfortunate part of all this is the House has operated in very secret chambers without giving anyone else the opportunity to participate and bring all facts to the table, which really needs to be done. Now they're going to start holding public hearings, which of course is important. The people need to have to hear this and hear what the charges are and what the answers to those charges are also. The unfortunate part of all this is here in Washington, D.C., the impeachment process is truly sucking the oxygen out of the air. It's makes it difficult to get anything else done, and we have a lot of work to do and a lot of things that really need to be done, and it's unfortunate, but until this is behind us, matters are going to be put on the back burner here. So that's where it is, I'm like all the jurors here, keeping an open mind. We'll listen to the matter seriously, and then we'll vote, and then as we've done in the past, we'll move on as a nation. That's where it lies, and that's where it is. So, Marty, let's go to the next question.
All right. Thank you, Senator. For anyone who's just joining us, to submit a question, please press 0. You will be transferred to a member of staff who will take your name and your question. If your question is chosen, I will say your name and ask you to repeat your question for Senator Risch. All right. We have Bonnie from Boise who is on the line who would like to ask about the Keystone Pipeline. Bonnie, you are now connected with Senator Risch.
I think that's David Hawk.
Oh, I apologize. David, you are with us.
Okay. Senator Risch would like to know if we're going to ever get the Keystone Pipeline built and if we're going to get ANWR available for leasing to the industry. And I appreciate your support on those things.
Well, thank you, David. I really appreciate that question. The Keystone Pipeline has been a long time coming, but it's going to get done, as with any project of that size these days. It does take time to get done. You always wish it could be done more quickly. There are more efficient ways, it seems to me, to process these applications and not go on for as long as this has gone on. But I really believe it's going to get done. As far as ANWR is concerned, that bill has passed, and ANWR will be open for production. For people who are worried about ANWR, ANWR stands for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and it is a huge tract of land in Alaska. I don't have the exact acreage in front of me, but it's bigger than some states, and the opportunity to drill for oil in ANWR is very tiny. It's been compared to the head of a pin on a football field. I mean, it's you couldn't see it from the air without flying directly over it. So ANWR is going to be protected. Indeed, the law that passed created protections for ANWR. Yes, it is going to be opened up, and yes, there'll be production from ANWR. One of the interesting points that has really been lost with all the economic prosperity that we have today is the fact that when the clock struck midnight January 1st, December 31st to January 1st, the United States officially became the largest producer of oil in the world. We passed Saudi Arabia, we passed Russia, we passed Venezuela, we passed every one of the countries that are large oil producers and gas producers for that matter, and it is strictly because of the work everyone has done to make oil more available to our consumers, but also because of the great technology that the engineers have developed for producing more oil and gas. And it's American technology, it's U.S. technology, invented here and refined here, and it's doing really good things for us. So things are a lot different today when it comes to production of energy than what we've had in the past. So that's a good thing. Thanks for that question, David.
All right. For anybody who's just joining us, if you would like to submit a question for Senator Risch, please press 0 at any time. We are now going to take a call from Randy, who would like to ask the senator about the national debt. Randy, you are now on with the senator.
Thank you, Senator, for holding this. My question is, or maybe it's a statement, I'm not sure, but I'd like you to respond to it. For the last 15 years, I think, we've been hearing about the crisis of the national debt. It has more than doubled in that time. Republicans are always on the forefront of complaining and promising to do something about the national debt. But really, in the long run, I don't see them doing anything more than talking about it when it's campaign season. But let's face it, we've had the House of Representatives for the last 10 years, except for the last year and a half, and the Senate for quite some time. And it keeps going up. I think that that's a convenient campaign topic, but really when it comes right down to it, you got to keep running up the bills in order to promise free stuff to people in order to get elected. And we really need to stop that, because that is our biggest deal. Because the people that are spending our money aren't the ones going to be paying the bills. It's going to be our children and our grandchildren that are. And I would like you to address that, please.
You know, Randy, first of all, that's a really, really good question. And it is a very fair criticism. And it is a legitimate criticism of both political parties and everybody that serves in Congress. Let me first of all, give just a very short tutorial on spending here. We spend around, these are very round numbers, but we usually, Senator Crapo and I don't vote for the spending bills, but the federal government spends about $4 trillion a year. Now, out of that $4 trillion, we only vote on about $1 trillion of it. $3 trillion of it is on autopilot. And that $3 trillion that is on autopilot are what are called entitlements. It includes Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and certain veterans' benefits. You don't vote on them because when they were set up, they were put on autopilot, and every year the people who qualify get the benefits, particularly people who've worked for them who should get the benefits and were promised the benefits, they get those. They have COLAs, automatic COLAs, increasers in them every year. And that is $3 trillion of the budget, and it's really what's causing the problem. The other $1 trillion, one-fourth of the budget, 25%, covers everything else. It covers defense, it covers agriculture, education, technology, the national laboratories, the national parks. Everything else falls into that last category. We actually do a pretty good job on that particular category. We fight like cats and dogs over it, but it is an adversarial system. It should be. The problem is the three-fourths of the budget that is on autopilot. And you're absolutely right. They started commissions and conferences and committees and everything else about 7 years ago, and had big meetings and big plans and everything else, and then walked away from it. And these were on the entitlement issues, and nothing was ever done. So as a result of that, today we are borrowing $1.25 billion a day. Let me say that again. The United States of America borrows $1.25 billion a day. Now, before I came to D.C., I think I was like most Americans. I thought, what difference does it make? You know, they've got the printing presses; they can print the money. But it's actual borrowing. I went out one day and watched them do it to the Bureau of Public Debt, and it's staggering to sit there and watch them borrow that kind of money. And it really brings home to us what you said, and that is that our kids and our grandkids are going to have to pay for this. This is real borrowing. I mean, the day I went out there, they borrowed about a fourth of it came from China, and three-fourths of it came from other wealthy banks and institutions around the world. They don't loan us money because they like us, and the interest rate is very low. The reason they loan us money is because they know they're going to get it back. Historically, the only place in the world that has never defaulted is the United States Treasury, so that's why the money's loaned. But look, it's a really serious problem, and unfortunately, on a really good day, there's only a handful of us that preach about this on a regular basis. We just can't keep doing this. But it is going to take reform of the entitlement programs. It's not the other spending, the usual kind of spending that we fight over that's causing this problem. But every American should be aware of this. Everybody should know these numbers. I wish everybody could have gone with me to the Bureau of Public Debt and watched this as we went out borrowing from other countries. And I think people would have a lot different view of how the federal government spends money. And believe me, out of all the stuff people, you know, I'm on the Intelligence Committee and I'm on the Foreign Relations Committee, and I see lots and lots of stuff that goes around the world, and people say to me, well, what keeps you up at night? Well, it isn't that as much as the financial condition of the country. It is not good, and it's not getting better, and the sun comes up every morning, the sun goes down every night, and we're another $1.25 billion in debt, and something's got to be done about it. But anyway, thanks for the question. I hope everybody takes note of that and pressure people that are in Congress that they can't. This just can't go on. It has got the spending that is that kind of spending has got to be reformed. There's no question about it. Thanks so much for that question.
All right, thank you. And for folks who are just joining us, as a reminder, if you would like to submit a question for Senator Risch, please press 0 at any time. We now have a caller who is a farmer and would like to speak about tariffs. Caller, you are now connected with Senator Risch.
Yeah, this is Tracy Walton. Thank you for doing this. This is a good idea. I've loved all the questions. I've want to talk about the trade. We know previous administrations, United States has gotten hurt on the trade. Now we're fighting it, but the farmers kind of getting hurt with this new trade war. And I'm supporting President Trump in it, but kind of curious of how long it's going to take us before, you know, it turns around. So we're not getting hurt so bad.
Well, that's a really good question. First of all, what we need to do is to understand where we are financially in this country. I won't live to see another time of prosperity like we have in America today. We're operating with record low unemployment or very close to it. In some sectors, African-American male youth and all Hispanics, the actual unemployment rate is at historic lows. They've never been lower. Stock market's at an all-time high. Wages and salaries are increasing dramatically. And as a matter of fact, the place where they're increasing the most, the highest percentage, is in the lower incomes and lower salaries. And so things are good in America. I mean, we're doing really, really well. Now, obviously, when you get into trade issues, we wind up with pockets of people that are that do get hurt by those things. We Republicans are free traders. We don't believe in tariffs. We want people to be able to trade freely from country to country. You know, human beings have been trading amongst each other long before there were governments, and they did a pretty good job of it without the government being involved. The more the government gets involved, the more difficult it becomes. Now, I understand that tariffs are needed occasionally. If you get a situation where either an industry or a particular business or something is being heavily subsidized by a government, and then they go out and sell products that are really unlawfully below what should be charged for those products, I can understand where a directed tariff can be used and should be used. And there's been some, probably one of the best examples of that Idahoans would be familiar with is the softwood timber industry, where Canada subsidizes the industry, and then the United States gets flooded with lumber, and it's a problem. So I see where that tariff works. But generally speaking, tariffs are not a good thing, and we don't like them. The president has a little different view on this than I do and most everybody else up here, and he and I and others have had spirited discussions about this. Having said that, he decided he wanted to take apart NAFTA and redo it, and we all cringed when that happened because we all know that NAFTA's been a real boon for us over the years. But to his credit, he pursued that, and when he did, at the end of the day, it turns out he was right. He negotiated a better deal than what we had. Unfortunately, the agreement has passed the Senate and is hung up in the House because the Speaker won't run it. It's unfortunate, but she's really not in charge of the House. There's four people over there that are running the House besides her, and they won't let her run it. We think that we're going to get a run on that before the end of the year, and that the USMCA, also known as NAFTA 2.0, will become the law of the land, and that's good. Turning to the big one, obviously we have a number of trade agreements out there, but the big one, of course, is China. And as we've argued with the president to some avail, this is a give and take proposition, but he really dislikes. Well, he doesn't like multilateral agreements. He likes bilateral agreements, and indeed, that's what hung up the USMCA for longer than it should have been hung up. But eventually, he agreed to the multilateral agreement where we had all three of us in it. So now we had a number of others that were kicking around out there, and he wants to do them bilaterally, which is fine if you get it done. And we have pressed him, and we press him regularly to get it done. As far as China's concerned, again, when he started that, we cringed, and we didn't know if he'd be able to do that or not. But again, he had them very close earlier this year to an agreement. And what was holding it up, most people think that it's the tariffs or the the amount of goods that can come from country to country or that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is, really, what was holding it up is IP, intellectual property. The Chinese have flat stolen our intellectual property. And intellectual property has a value just like hard property does. And it belongs to the people who invented it or created it. And that doesn't bother the Chinese. They just go out and steal it. You don't have to look very far if you live in Idaho to see an example of that, a real poster child for that, and that's Micron Technology. Some Chinese went and stole their trade secrets, stole some of their patents. They went to China. They patented the stuff there, and now they're suing Micron in the Chinese court. It's just not right. And look, you've got to give the president credit on this. He is holding the Chinese feet to the fire on intellectual property. And if we don't get this right, it's going to be a real problem for everybody for the rest of the 21st century. And China has got to, first of all, develop a rule of law. Secondly, enforce that rule of law. And thirdly, accept international norms when it comes to intellectual property. If we don't force them into that position, it's going to be a long 21st century for all of us. So in any event, we really think the president's idea of taking it the first step here pretty quickly is going to come to fruition in short order. Of course, we have every time we seem to get a little close, we get a hiccup. We have lots of issues with the Chinese, and not the least of which is Hong Kong and their incursions in the South China Sea. And as I was pointing out, their human rights, they have a couple of Idahoans in jail there that shouldn't be in jail there. These things all hold up these agreements. And we need to get them done. I get that. I think that whether you're in the farming business or whether you're in any business at all that deals in items today, trade is important because the world is shrinking, and more and more and more there's trade between countries. So it's important he get these done. We will do our part in the Senate to approve them as quickly as we can get our hands on them. And like I said, we urge him regularly to do that. In fact, I'm having lunch with him tomorrow. In fact, I'm having lunch and dinner with him tomorrow, and it'll be a topic of discussion, I'm sure, at both of them, along with lots and lots of other things that are going on in the world. Thanks for that great question, and it is really important to us, to Americans, and to our economy. So thanks much.
All right, thank you. As a reminder to people who are just joining us, if you would like to submit a question for Senator Risch, please press 0 at any time. We now have a call from Jeff, who would like to talk about the Columbia River Treaty. Jeff, you are now live with the senator.
Hi, Senator. You spoke a little bit about the Columbia River Treaty at the beginning, and I was wondering if you could just elaborate on that a little bit more. Some of us are just concerned about that, you know, some of the aspects that we're hearing about that, some of the parties up there around here are, talking about incorporating fish into that and some of those sorts of things. So could you just speak to that a little bit more and what you're hearing about that treaty?
Yeah, I sure can. Look, I meet with the negotiators regularly. This is of critical importance to me, obviously, as an Idahoan, and of course, as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, it's right in my wheelhouse. So, I'm going to be dealing with it, and I am dealing with it on a regular basis. But look, we have had this treaty in place for some time with Canada, and it regulated it. It was an agreement to regulate two things. One was flood control. The other was generation of electricity. It is starting, it will expire in 2024, so it needs to be renegotiated now, and it's a good thing for us to get started on it. One of the things that I started with as chairman of the committee, and I told them, do not bring me a treaty that starts to wade into the issue of salmon. We have enough troubles as it is amongst ourselves, amongst the states, amongst the various interests, we don't need to start arguing with the Canadians over how we should manage the fish in the Columbia. We have plenty of laws in the United States to cover this. We can handle this ourselves, and if it entered into the negotiations, I really fear that it would break down and we wouldn't be able to reach an agreement. It's going to be tough enough as it is, as far as the two items that we have to agree on. And I can tell you that this is not a partisan issue. You read lots and lots of stuff about how things up here are all partisan. It isn't. One of my closest partners on this is Maria Cantwell, who's a Democrat senator from Washington. She and I talk about this regularly. When we meet with the negotiator, we generally, the two of us, meet together. And we're of the same frame of mind, and that is that we want the Canadians to be reasonable. They of course, are after more money, and that's the way things in the world work today. But we're gonna require that they do be reasonable. They can't charge us for a drop of water simply because it happened to fall in Canada instead of in the United States, and it's going to come down to Columbia anyway. So, look, we're neighbors. We've been friends country to country for a long time. We're about as close to them as we are every country in the world. We'll get through this, but we're going to be tough negotiators, and we're going to get this done. As every time we deal with this, it's somebody downstream that wants Idaho's water for one thing or another, be it for flood control, or be it for generation of electricity, or be it for salmon. And we've given and given and given from Idaho, and we're going to see that Idaho's rights are protected, and that we do the right thing for Idahoans on this Columbia River Treaty. And I'm committed to that. So long as I'm chairman of this committee, I guarantee you there's going to be no treaty go through this committee that isn't beneficial to Idaho. So thanks for that question, and I give you my commitment. We'll work at it to make sure that we get the good deal. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And for people who are just joining us, if you would like to submit a question for Senator Risch, please press 0 at any time. We now have Robert, who would like to speak about IP. Robert, you are now live with Senator Risch.
Hi, thank you, Senator. My question is, how do you feel about our security against hostile nations for cyber attacks? You'd mentioned the IP problem with tariffs and everything, but what about our security?
You know, that's a really good question. I said in my opening statement, I just referred to it parenthetically, I guess, is that this is of real concern to the United States. I think that the next significant attack on America is going to be a cybersecurity attack. They're after us constantly. There are thousands come in. As we're sitting here speaking, there are people attempting to break into the electrical grid or to the Defense Department or all kinds of different places, both for fraudulent purposes, for national security purposes, and all those things. So cybersecurity is very, very important. It has I'm on the Intelligence Committee, so I see regularly the kind of attacks that they do, how they do it. We've looked at the ways they've gotten through, and we're allocating a fair amount of money for that because obviously, if there is a successful attack, it's going to cost the United States of America a whole lot of money, and the taxpayers also. So you'll be interested to hear that the Idaho National Laboratory is becoming the flagship for this. We have several laboratories in the United States. We have been the flagship lab for nuclear energy at INL for since the dawn. In fact, it was born there. Nuclear energy was born there at the INL. Today, the same thing is happening with cybersecurity for two reasons. Number one, the Idaho National Laboratory has the expertise in the world when it comes to control systems. Control systems were developed as nuclear energy was developed, and as a result, we have the best when it comes to scientists and when it comes to equipment as far as control systems are concerned. And obviously, all of the cybersecurity attacks have to go through some type of a control system. Secondly, one of the favorite targets of terrorists, and for that matter, a lot of these people that are attacking for one reason or another, is the electrical grid. We have a number of very unique things at the Idaho National Laboratory where they can actually do testing on the electrical grid to see how the attacks occur, and secondly, how they can repel these attacks. We also have developed at the lab a great cooperative relationship with many, many different industries, starting with, of course, the utility industries, which I said is a favorite target. And we have teams that do respond when there are issues, that come up where there has been an attack. It's so important that we formed a lab caucus here in the Congress, and I'm a co-chair with Senator Durbin, who's a Democrat from Illinois. The two of us chair the lab caucus. We meet with them regularly, and this is a good thing for America, the protection that the lab offers. And secondly, it's a great thing for Idaho because there are a lot of jobs created and a lot of work gets done on cybersecurity right in the great state of Idaho. Thanks for that question. It's a serious matter.
All right. Thank you. And we still have folks that are joining tonight's Teletown Hall. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. This is a live question and answer session with Senator Risch. If you would like to ask a question, please press 0 on your telephone keypad. You will then be transferred to a staff member who will take your name and question. You can also press 0 if you would like to simply leave a comment or if you have an issue that you need assistance with. We'd like to get through as many of your questions as possible. To help us accomplish this goal, we must limit all callers to only one question. If your question is chosen, I will say your name and ask for you to repeat your question for Senator Risch. Once again, to submit a question, please press 0 at any time during the call. You will then be transferred to a member of staff who will take your name and your question. You can also press 0 at any time if you would like to simply leave a comment or if you have an issue that you need assistance with. We now have Robin on the line who would like to ask the Senator about sanctuary cities. Robin, you are now live with the Senator.
Okay, thank you very much. You know, this is really special to be able to speak to a senator in this format, so thank you very much. My concern is the protection of our borders, and I just didn't know where you stood on it, and I just wanted to know how you did stand on it. Thank you very much.
Well, good. Thank you. That was that is a good question, a very fair question. Look, I'm a hawk when it comes to border protection. You don't have a country if you can't protect your borders. Every country is entitled to its sovereignty. That is to determine who comes in and who doesn't come in. And you can't have control of that sovereignty if you do not have control of your borders. Now, most countries do not protect their borders like we do. Most countries have laws where if you cross the border illegally, you pay a real price for it. Let me give you an example. We had three hikers who were hiking in Iraq, and they were United States citizens, and they were simply on vacation. They were hiking in Iraq and accidentally crossed into Iran. No, they were just students. They weren't carrying any illicit things or anything else. They spent 8 years in prison simply because they wandered into Iran accidentally and only in a very minimal fashion. But they were arrested by Iranian soldiers. They were taken and tried, and they were sentenced to 8 years in prison. Now, when a country does that, that is the best, not a very humanitarian thing to do, but it is the best way to control the border because people simply will not cross the border because they know there's a price to pay. The United States, we use a combination of physical border and patrols to control our borders. It is very porous. It is difficult. It is easy to get through. It is easy to get across those borders. The last four presidents, not counting President Trump, but the last four presidents, two Republicans, two Democrats, built about 650 miles of physical security, also known as a border wall. And where the border wall exists in those 650 miles, we have very, very good border security. The problem, of course, is people will avoid the physical wall and go to a place where there isn't a physical wall and cross in. This can't go on. This spring particularly, we had a situation where we had about 100,000 people a month crossing the southern border illegally and coming into the United States. Let me say that again. 100,000 people a month coming in. And so we're on track to get about 1 million this year come in illegally across the southern border. When they come in, of course, these are people, we're humanitarians here in the United States. They need to be fed, they need to be housed, they need medical care, and all that, all that comes with that. And as a result of that, the president has done some adjusting of the numbers for refugees that are coming in legally through the refugee programs. And when people enter illegally, it just really upsets the laws that you want in place to regulate this sort of thing. So, look, I feel very, very strongly about protecting our borders and seeing that people come in legally. We are a country of immigrants. We will probably be a country of immigrants for many years to come. And indeed, we have people from all over the world that are coming in here legally, and people who are complying with United States law for immigration, and that's the way people should come into this country. We want people here that will immigrate legally. We have we have real employment problems in America right now with a shortage of workers. There are some particular industries that are hurting very badly. We need a guest worker program that works really well. We don't have that right now, and we need just overall immigration reform, but it has become very political. The president needs to be commended. He pressured Mexico pretty hard to slow the flow down coming through Mexico. The southern border of Mexico is very narrow, whereas our southern border is very wide. And his argument to the Mexican government was to control that southern border because the illegal immigration that I spoke of at 100,000 a month was coming not so much from Mexico, but from the Northern Triangle, from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, and those were where they were coming from. Well, to get to the United States southern border, they had to cross into Mexico. Mexico was not controlling its southern border, and the president pressured them. And so now the numbers are down, but we still have unacceptable numbers coming in. And so I feel strongly about that. My colleagues up here feel strongly about that. And we want to get control of the border so we can have a legal, lawful immigration system in America that works and works for everybody.
All right. We now have Edith, who is on the line, who would like to speak about USMCA. Edith, you are now live with the senator.
Hello, Senator. Thank you for taking my call. This is really nice. As I mentioned earlier, my question is, why is the USMCA is not being passed? It's been in there in the Democrat for a long period of time now. This will be a tremendous job for the people. And if Pelosi is not capable is not capable of doing her job, then is it possible that it could be given to somebody there that can do the job?
Well, I wish it was that simple. I couldn't agree with you more. I voted for that when it came to the United States Senate. We did our job. We did it quickly and efficiently, and we approved the USMCA, and as you noted, it went over to the House of Representatives. The House actually can pass bills quicker and easier than the Senate can. Our rules are much more arcane here, and it's easy to stop stuff here. Look, this is all in the hands of you, as you pointed out, Nancy Pelosi. If she woke up tomorrow morning and decided they were going to pass USMCA, she could walk it to the floor, they could have a vote, and that would be the end of it right there. She won't do that, and she's being pressured by some people that are in her conference that do not want to give President Trump a victory. We want to see the House pass the House pass it, and we keep pressuring our friends over there and saying, look, you need to get a vote on that. We want that passed, and that's where it is. So thanks for the question, and we'll keep pressuring them.
All right, we have time for one more question tonight for tonight's Teletown Hall. We have Donna, who would like to speak about millennials. Donna, you are now connected with the senator.
Yes, I have a question. The millennials embrace socialism, and they're voters. Are the Republicans doing anything to get the message out that socialism is bad and not the way to go? The media won't report on it. Is there any way to override that?
I really appreciate that question. One of the things that distinguishes America from everyone else in the world is our embracement of capitalism. It was free markets, capitalism, entrepreneurialism that our founding fathers believed would give us a standard of living that we wanted. And they were absolutely right. I go out and I speak to the high school kids all the time, and I'm always surprised when I ask them, who can tell me the difference between capitalism and socialism? And they look at you like, I don't know, you know. And when you tell them, look, this is so simple. In a socialist society, all capital, all money, is owned and controlled by the government. In a capitalist society, we, the people, own and control all of the capital. When that happens, the people actually have the ability to make decisions for themselves as to how they want that capital expended, how they want it deployed to create jobs and to invest and make things better. In socialism, it's the government that makes all the decisions. And as we all know, government decision-making is really almost an oxymoron. It's just not something that's efficient. It's not like a marketplace that sorts out the good from the bad and what people really want. And so we've embraced capitalism. America once before had this a flirtation with socialism. It was back in the 1920s and 1930s. And after some wrangling, it was roundly rejected, and we continued to embrace capitalism. But we're Americans. We're free people. We can do whatever we want. I wouldn't say necessarily that all millennials embrace socialism. I think people that are younger don't really have the foundational things that are necessary to make decision making like other people who have had a lot of history with it with decision making. And so as you point out, the younger people are more willing to embrace socialism, but as they get older, more and more they see that indeed it is capitalism that gives us what we want. It's wealth creation. It's the ability to wake up in the morning and go out and work hard, create wealth, create income for yourself and your family, to be able to hang on to it and not have to turn it over to the government. And that's what free people do, and that's how free people operate. So thank you so much for that. I'm bound to the free market system, to capitalism, and fortunately the large majority of Americans feel the same way today. Well, thank you all for participating tonight. Certainly we've had some great questions and some hard questions, but that's the way that it should be done. And I want to thank you on behalf of myself and thank my staff for what they've done and helped in putting this together. And we're going to do this again. So look forward to any of you who want to join again. We certainly welcome you, and we'll do this to get the message out and to answer the questions that you have. So God bless you all for participating, and good night.